You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Gingell.
And we're talking today about two films by the French director Jacques Tati. I should do a shout out to the person who told us to do this because we immediately stole their idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thanks to Matthew Lloyd Roberts.
This is definitely slightly beset. Not only, well, it's a lovely hot day, so you're going to have a lot more incidental background rumble. Noises, inexplicable noises from machinery.
Should we say something very brief in passing about who Tati is? We're talking principally about two of his films, Mon Oncle, which is, I don't even know when it's from. Is it from like late
1957?
And Playtime, which is sort of bankruptcy-inducing magnum opus, which came out 10 years later. So Tati, French but of sort of vague Russian ancestry, born in 1907. So he was about 40 when he started to become successful. And his first film, which sort of received a lot of success, was Jour de Fête.
I think he'd done a number of B films that were shown. This is in the era when you would have a short film before the main one, and he'd done a bit. So he'd been actually working for quite a long time.
And in the 30s, he had achieved modest fame as a mime, and there's this sort of much quoted description of his act by Colette saying how marvellous it was and that he'd invented a new art form or something. I think this is one of those ones which shows how tastes change, because I mean, there are no recordings of when he was actually doing this show, but there are some later ones he did, and there are also bits of the act which crept into films and things. It's he would do things like pretend to be riding a horse or pretend to be having a boxing match with an invisible adversary or whatever. It's quite hard to see what people found so extraordinary, but
it was a genre, and I think it has to do with, I know nothing about this subject. A logical thing would be to say silent film was a very popular medium and it was mime.
But in a sense you could say that he is a bit of a man out of time. The sort of figures in film that he really looks to are people of the silent era. They're people like Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd. When he eventually won the foreign language Oscar for Mon Oncle, they were the ones who he went and met up with and had photos taken with and things. But of course, he's actually recording in the late 50s and 60s. So he's literally sort of displaced from the time when that sort of cinema seems to belong, and that's very appropriate because his films are also very much about and set in a world which seems to be being displaced from an old nostalgic historic form into a new, possibly threatening and certainly alienating modernity. And that's really one of the things which comes through as the key theme of both of these films, is the sense that the world is changing and that his sort of bumbling, awkward character, Monsieur Hulot, exemplifies these people who are slightly all at sea. Shall we start talking about Mon Oncle?
Yeah. Well, we can say that, like, his fourth successful films, like, really quickly, his career is... He's doing a mime artist and things. He makes, in the 30s, very soon after the war, he makes a series of shorts, which are modestly successful, and get him the ability to make his first feature film.
It's about the postman who wants to... He reads about or sees something about the Pony Express and then becomes, like, an absurdly fast postman.
He wants to be as fast as any American postman, which actually was from his earlier short film, The School for Postmen. And then he gets the money to make his most successful film,
Monsieur Hulot's Holiday,
which introduces us to the same character, but I think he's formalised a bit.
He's hard to describe, isn't it? He's sort of stiff. He always wears an overcoat. He has this strange hat. He has this sort of strange mannered way of walking where he's kind of... His stride length is too long. Sort of lunging, this strange sort of lunging
walk. He's old-fashioned, restrained, always carefully dressed, but not dapper. Yeah. He's also bumbling. He's got some characteristics out of a P.G. Wodehouse novel. He doesn't want to work at all, but he doesn't resist it strongly. He usually doesn't want to do any of the things that he's doing. Mainly he wants to run around and have japes.
Yeah. Yeah, he can't resist children or small dogs. Yeah, he sort of instantly kind of entrances
playing with objects, like encountering an unusual object, he will immediately sort of try out its material and phenomenal affordances. A chair must be sat on, squeezed, prodded, turned over, examined. a button must be pressed, repressed, examined. If something has an unusual modern property, it must be explored.
Yeah, so that one, he kind of, which I think is most, it's particularly a satire of the kind of mannerisms of the French bourgeoisie, isn't it? These sort of pretensions. They're all at a holiday resort on, I think, on the Atlantic coast. I'm not sure what there is to say about the film really, except that it's highly recommended, that one. It's very funny.
It's good family. You can watch it with everyone.
I think the things which are really good, there's a wonderful tennis scene, which exhibits something we'll go into more, but Tati has this amazing use of sounds which are strange or just slightly off.
You know the exaggerated quality here? It brings the exaggerated quality of silent films to the sound, which is entirely Foley and recorded afterwards. He doesn't record the dialogue ever as it's being spoken.
Monsieur Hulot's tennis game is eerily reminiscent of my own dear father's, in a way that's always very funny. You may be listening. Hi, if so.
Ready? Let's start. 15. Oh, splendid. 30. 40.
My dad listened to one episode and said he didn't get it. He said we were just talking about nothing.
Yeah, that's new media. Welcome to new media, yeah.
Waffling on about
nothing. It's talking about nothing and then asking people for money for it.
Well, we've managed stage one.
So Mon Oncle is the follow-up to Les Vacances de Monsieur Hulot, and it's the same character, but now we learn a little bit more about his family situation. Maybe we could describe the opening scene, because it very effectively situates you within the sort of fictional landscape and the different places, doesn't it?
The very first thing you see is there is a construction site, and there's a big, like, sign, which is the credits, done really nicely.
And it has the sound of all these guys pneumatically hammering various things. Not often for any
beep,
very obvious purpose.
Beep, beep.
And it's a sort of, like, really messy construction site where they're knocking down a bunch of charming old bits of the city.
Bits of the city and replacing them with shiny, grey, modernist blocks. And then dogs.
Yeah, dogs.
A gaggle of five dogs or so.
Yeah, all these little dogs. And they're
one of which is wearing a very fetching, tight, red check dog jacket.
Yes, there's a pampered dog, and there are four sort of naughty dogs, and they're all eating out of bins and things.
The pampered dog is also naughty, though.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
an
yeah.
illusion.
And they all go kind of running around all the streets of this very picturesque old bit of cityscape.
Yeah,
which has, I guess we can describe it, you know, it has old cobbled streets, it has a square, it has plain trees.
There's
it
a little square which has got a cafe. The buildings are tall, rendered, you know, French provincial town. Very attractive.
Rather higgledy-piggledy, yeah.
There are vegetable sellers of a rustic comedic character.
Yes, stout.
It's definitely the
russet
comic set. Yeah, stout. Well, not well. One is stout and one is thin. One is always at the cafe and one is always cheating people.
And they so the dogs all go running, and then they enter like this series of different places. They enter this place where there's a strange wiggly road with in like insanely large numbers of markings on it, behind which are a whole series of these entirely grey, blank, completely abstract grey forms, rather funereal, which is obviously the new kind of mass housing. And they go running past that, and then they run down this little, absurdly little street, but which has its own traffic light for no very obvious reason. Yeah. And then they go running, and then they reach this smart automatic gate, and the smart little dog pushes through and tears its jacket in the process. And it is the dog of this family who I can't remember what they're called, but they're,
yeah, she's vacuum cleaning. And I first time I watched it, I watched it in such poor quality that I thought she'd used the end of the vacuum cleaner to pick up the dog and taken it in, but which would have been a good moment.
And so what we've done is to basically traverse between the homes of the two,
yeah, and go through all the sets. There aren't very many places.
So Monsieur Hulot lives in a flat in the picturesque old city. He is the uncle, the titular uncle, yeah, of the little boy who lives with the couple in this smart new modernist villa with its automatic gate and fountain and all sorts of mod cons, of which more later. So yeah, there's a kind of, there's a pairing of these two houses, aren't there? And they're both very very sort of amusingly thought through and full of eccentric sort of characteristic eccentricities. So the should we talk about Tatty's about Hulot's apartment, which is right at the top of one of these apartment buildings.
If you imagine a cross between the Addams Family house and a beautiful French provincial townhouse, you'd sort of be there. You get the sense that somewhere in the back of it is a sort of old tenement house, but there have been various bits built on around it, a sort of jutting wooden bits and things. And the first thing that happens is he goes in one door, and then you see him walk along, and he appears at one window, goes up one flight of stairs, goes to the other side, and at each moment is encountering another person, and there's this sense of this community living in the place, and they sort of call up and down to each other. And he lives perched on his eyrie, which is a sort of single room in a mansard on the very top, accessible only by going through about four different staircases.
Yeah, he absurdly appears at pretty much every window on the facade in turn, and sometimes he kind of goes up and then comes back down again and then goes back up a different way.
Yeah.
And then eventually the sort of magician's trick is that he appears from around the corner of a balcony and then walks into a door in the that you're expecting him to walk out of.
A lot of the key style is you have the pacing of the scenes is always about the same, but the amount of action that goes on in them varies enormously. And there's a lot of very slow someone walking around for a lot longer than would be permissible now.
They're kind of very slow sight gags, aren't they? And he often plays with your expectations.
There's two joke tricks that he employs a lot, one of which is a very famous one, which is where you can see something and a character cannot see it, and so the consequence, and then you can play with either the thing happening or not happening. And the other one is something has got a visual affordance, it's set up to happen, but it happens in a different way.
Yeah.
Oh, ha, ha, these sound so funny when you explain them.
they are very funny.
But they're very good.
And we never actually go into his little flat, but his thing, every time he goes home, he...
So one characteristic is that you have to go round. And when he opens his balcony window, the reflected light of the pane of glass shines into a budgerigar's cage on the other side, and it makes song. So when he opens and closes the window, there's this moment of bird song, and he sort of plays around with that.
Yeah, he tries to get it so that it's shining onto the budgie so that it continuously sings. It's this funny, yeah.
It's very peculiar. But that happens all the way, whenever he goes home.
And it's another one of these absolutely characteristic sort of sound jokes, isn't it? Because he's just bringing the budgie track in or out at certain points.
The other characteristic of it is that there is a community living in the building. There's the woman who does his washing, there's his landlady, there's his landlady's daughter.
Yeah, there's a woman who, in a sort of nightdress, who he has to walk past on the stair.
Not notice. Yeah. Yes.
Well, he has to sort of turn and face the wall, although you can only tell this from where the position of his shoes, which you can see through the window.
Yeah, they've got a really interesting window in the staircase, which is at foot level, which you would think is completely ridiculous, but I have definitely seen that.
But we have them in the building I work in, yeah. I don't know how they come about, but they do.
I think the same sort of thing that leads people to put the structural columns in behind all the windows.
Yeah. The devil.
Liveware error, yes. Oh, God, there is a moment in the second film where... there's a lot of jollity, but an architect has not performed very well. And actually, I felt a creeping sense of
you
nausea.
Were triggered.
I felt sick, sick to my stomach.
Oh yeah, that's quite a good
triggering
moment.
Isn't it, that one?
There's always stuff going on. Everything is a permanent sort of picturesque street scene. They have the little market going on, and they have these little
the market seems to only, there's two stalls, one of which only sells endives. basically just Frise lettuce.
The Frise lettuce selling guy who's so lazy he won't even get it. He's just sitting in the cafe across the square and people come up and like wave at him and then throw random denominations of money
says,
into
no,
his...
not that one. You want the one next to it. Well, he's brought them in his little cart from the countryside. He's
yeah,
done his,
nice.
Well, his day's
it's
work
nice.
Is done.
And there's the rag and bone man in
who
his,
is
wagon.
A great friend of Monsieur Hulot.
Yeah, any old iron.
Bring out your dead. That's a different one.
That
they say any old iron, any old iron, any old iron.
Yeah, we used to have those when I was a kid.
I can remember seeing someone in a cart doing it. That's the plot of Steptoe and Son as well, isn't it?
That is a trade which is pretty gone now.
It was looking, I would say its viability was looking pretty shonky when we were small.
So anyway, that's it. But there's, you know, this is a kind of eroding coastline, isn't it? This old city.
Yeah.
And there's a view which they keep walking through, which has a sort of tumbled down wall and an old sort of 19th century lamp, which is askew, and some ivy and stuff. And beyond that, you can see all these identical cuboidal blocks of flats rising in the distance and characters. But dogs, people, all kind of walk in and out through this
over this
gap.
Little
yeah.
break in the wall.
And... Well, should we talk about the house? Because the house
yeah,
is also
and then
very funny.
On the other side, so there's these two sort of... It's like a sci-fi world, right? Yes. There's except that the like ripple effect expanding dome of modernity is kind of... Instead of that, it's this like fallen down wall. But you go when you go through, you're in a never-never land of like modern blocks at a distance, yeah. but then this villa up close, this wonderful... exciting modern villa with such luxurious features.
I'll put a picture of it up because it's very funny. It's been made to look, it's got these two funny little eyes, these porthole windows, and
yes.
And it has this absurd fish fountain in the landscaped garden, and one of the jokes is that the incredibly house proud wife has to turn on the fish fountain before she can let anyone come in. So that
there's a gate. It's got like a brushed metal gate.
Yeah.
With a sort of jazzy atomic age pattern on a buzzer. She will turn the fountain on and then conveniently the tap is right by the buzzer.
Yeah, and then she'll buzz you in.
Which is presumably designed just for this. And when she turns the tap on, there's this... It's a brushed metallic fish. Head going up like some sort of, you know, sardine in a stargazy pie. And then it squirts out of its mouth... water that has been dyed blue.
And it gargles horribly when it's turning on and off as well.
Yes, particularly when it's turning off. It's very good.
Like,
yeah, sort of like the dying gasps.
And sometimes, you know, if it's the wrong type of person, then she'll just turn it straight off. But for important visitors, she wants it to be on.
Yes, it's very... Yeah, that's absolutely crucial.
We're always seeing her husband, who's this sort of big fat man in a suit, going off to work.
He is the manager of a plastic piping factory. He has listened to the admonition at the beginning of The Graduate.
Yes.
And has got into an expanding... What's it called? It's called, like, Plastac.
It's called Plastoc.
Plastoc.
One of the it has this sort of swooshy 50s typography, and one of the jokes is that the same typography is used also on the school,
which says school in English,
and also the restaurant they go to, and I think pretty much like everywhere
everything is one of the properties of modernism in Tati. This is in both films, is that everything is the same everywhere.
So everything is like a corrugated iron sort of cuboid with the same typography, but just a different word. So she kind of comes and fusses over him, and he goes off in his car to work.
She's got such a good day gown.
Yeah, it's like luminous green.
Luminous, like mint green, like the colour of a green toothpaste, with weird sort of floral pipings.
Yeah.
Made, I think, out of, like, raincoat material.
One of the features of their house is they have constant costume changes, and they also have constant sort of changes of furniture or location.
The other joke is there's nothing in the flat.
Yeah.
Like, it's continually being... She's continually cleaning. Very early on, the husband comes out, she gives him his coffee in the morning, and then one by one gives him each of the items he needs for the day, his gloves, his briefcase, his hat.
Oh, that's because she's hidden them all somewhere, has she?
Yeah,
in a cupboard.
In some recess. And each of them is dusted and wiped down. And then he gets into his car and she's cleaning the car.
As it's driving away.
As it's driving away. and everything is perpetually... The house is completely empty except for these odd, strange and ambiguous items of furniture. She's got an amazing kitchen as well. Her domain, which she says she's the boss of, such that there is a scene where there are a series of sensors on the cooker which create alarm bells with colour-coded lights in the living room so that when the steak is cooking... The red light flashes and then a green light pings and she has to go through into the kitchen and press a button, whereupon the steak, which is cooking directly on the hot plate, is flipped by a sort of pneumatic device.
Yeah.
Over.
It pings up in the air and comes down on the other side.
Like a toaster, you know, like toast coming out of a toaster. So there's this fantastic device which will tell you that you have to press the button.
Yeah. Almost all labour is saved, but...
Yes, but that is also very much a lot of activities are like...
The sort of tension in the film is between these two worlds, isn't it? So that Ulo, the uncle, sometimes comes to pick up the boy, sometimes gives him a ride home from school. He's sort of intruding into their lives in different ways. They invite him over to dinner. They try and set him up with one of their neighbours. They try and give him a job.
They keep trying to give him a job. They give him, over the course of the film, three different jobs. And as it turns out, he's not very good at any of them. The first one's a very strange story, isn't it? How he loses the first job. That is, it's completely...
It's kind of hard to describe, but it's quite funny, yeah.
It involves him getting lime whitewash on his shoe.
Yeah.
And then that leading them to think that he's leapt on a table to look out of a small porthole window.
Yeah, into the woman's toilets. Which he's innocent of that.
He's innocent
but
of that.
It's quite complicated how that happened.
Yes, that's the sort of joke. This is quite good because we can describe quite a lot and yet leave all of the quality of the scenario unrevealed.
When he arrives for that job interview, he goes in and then, just for no particular reason, he's surrounded by all these small dogs and all the small dogs run in. And then the guard has to spend quite a long time chasing all the small dogs
back
out again.
Well, he chases four of them out and then... And then the sort of door closes and there's a pause. There's about three beats. And then the door opens again and he throws the last one out.
We'll talk about them more in playtime, but the interiors of the sort of modern locations and factories and things are quite amazing.
And in this one, the difference with this one is they're incredibly sparse.
The walls are all made of like... They look like they're made of sort of translucent...
Yeah, like polycarbonate or something. That's in the plastic factory, yeah. Some sort of amazing... The other factory, which is another... It's a coal derivatives factory, whatever that means. It's got a good set as well. Yeah, the plastic factory, so much stuff goes on in it. There's stuff that's completely nothing to do with architectural interpretation, which is that he populates... All the scenes have got incidental characters... who are sort of on a sliding scale of how much they have an impact. They're always partly a stereotype with some strange physical characteristics or a tick. So in this one, there is a secretary in a pencil skirt who clops along making a sort of noise like a horse going click, 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 and has this very... But all the characters are like that. Later on in the party, there are quite a lot of characters, but they're all kind of archetypes. They're all archetypes and grotesques. Well, there's obviously a play of manners between the modern world, which is capitalist, efficient,
it's very, very,
very
pretentious,
controlled as well. Like the even in work and play, everything is extremely regimented. And the aspiration is extremely... There's a lot of aspiration. So at play, there's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses. And in work, there's mechanical regimentation.
And a lot of pointless labour, like in the plastic factory, there's a lot of people walking around just carrying hoses.
Carrying hoses round and round.
Yeah. The film very consciously creates these two places, though, doesn't it? I mean, one of the things which is distinctive, which I guess is more a kind of French version of urban modernity, is that the modern suburb and the location of the new mass housing are the same place. Whereas they would be different places if you were in America or if you were in the UK to some extent, wouldn't they?
I don't think that the middle class ever adopted villas here. They would rather have what they would call cottages, which are probably six cottages knocked into one.
Yes.
Each cottage having formerly been lived in by 13 people or something. Yeah. There's the one opposite where my mum lives, and it's a inverted commas cottage, and it was five houses which had one tap, and one of which had 13 people living in it, one of whom is still alive, and is now lived in by one little old lady. We don't really embrace the future in this country. We've not been known for a strong embrace of the future, really, at any point. More like hiding.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's not that it's totally absent, and I think we could probably find artworks which are a little bit about the embrace of the future. Like, I think there's a bit of that in Ballard, isn't there?
Yeah, although it seems to be set, like, High Rise feels like it's set, actually, in the Riviera or something. It doesn't, like, I read it when I moved into the Barbican, but it's not, it doesn't really feel like that. It feels like Costa del Brit, actually, like, but sort of very, but where everyone's got middle-class jobs, right?
Yeah, people are professionals, and that sort of still means something in Ballard, doesn't it? It sort of means something to be, like, a vet or a architect or whatever.
Well, I mean, actually, it means something in real life, doesn't it? I know we personally have attempted to subvert that by notionally being professionals but doing nothing of any worth, and dismally failing to sort of live middle class lives. But most people do. Most of our like a large number of our friendship group have bought flats.
They've managed to, haven't they?
And they like dress up smart. When we meet them, they're wearing quite smart clothes and they've got nice haircuts and things.
Yeah. Can't even look at them. Maybe we could just pick more interesting things to talk about and stuff will come out.
The key to the first film is that there's the family, the modernist family, and there's the modernist son. And he is drawn to old France.
He loves his uncle. He loves to play with his uncle.
And he loves the carts, and he loves the hawkers and the cafe. And he's got a gang of mates who are a reflection of the gang of dogs. Yeah. And he's the dog with the funny jackets. And
they have this sort of zone of freedom, which is this sort of scrubland. In between the two worlds, I think we're meant to read
it's an abandoned railway track. And they get up to various... They're definitely scamps.
Definitely, yeah.
They get up to various practical jokes.
They have a special joke about trying to get people to walk into lampposts by distracting them at a critical moment.
Yeah, and people and getting people to think that they've, like, pranged each other in the car.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Which leads to the funniest one, which is a woman criticising a very posh boy because he was walking by at the same time that she was back-ended by a guy in an enormous lorry. I guess what it's sort of building up to, well, there's a big set piece, which is this party, which has a lot of the kind of key characteristics of the film, which we could talk about in a technical sense. And then I think beyond that, it builds up to the accommodation, what the settlement is.
Yeah, between these things. Because old France isn't going to win, but somehow modern France has to learn some sort of important lesson from it. That's really the I mean, actually, in Playtime later, he talks about the set, or as in, like, the place is a character. And I think there is this sort of sense that the sets have a character arc, or the kind of values exemplified by the sets have to merge and learn from each other.
Static. A lot of long static shots in which people and objects move around. And there's also, like, the classic tatty shot is a fairly wide... and very deep focused shot.
Yeah.
In which an ensemble cast does like two or three different things at the same time in a very deep space, usually at like a two-thirds sort of type perspective, and things taking a very long time to interact or never interacting till two stories will build up.
Part of what makes the film work is that the modernity is very funny. But it's very ingeniously funny.
The mod cons are bizarre.
But the furniture also is absurd. Like, he has these this amazingly strange-looking sofas, which are just on the edge of plausibility.
Yeah. It's two, like, tennis ball green cylinders of felt.
Or there's another one which is like, it's like a kind of melon slice of green foam.
With a sort of funny balustrade going around it. Which then, like, you know, falls, gets drunk and falls asleep on having turned it on its side, where it becomes, like, an actual piece of modernist furniture, like an actual sort of Corby Rocky lounger.
Throughout, there are these absurd chairs, which are all, yeah.
Very, but they're all sort of versions of real chairs.
Yeah, they're just pushed a little bit to the limit.
The key thing is that you should look at it and be unsure as to what you're meant to do with the object. That, like, there's a joke of that. Yeah, I like the bullshit bingo word for me for this episode is going to be affordance.
Yeah.
Or affordances. There's a joke of affordances. Is that, do I sit on that? Yeah. Or do I press it?
Yeah.
Do I turn it over? How do I open that cupboard?
Answer, you sort of wave your hand in front of
you
it. Sort of, and then
you press a button and then you wave your hand in front of it and it kind of, yeah.
And then it goes,
yeah. But that joke actually runs right through both films. What it... This is a plain, ambiguous, modernist object. How do you interact with it?
And it all ties into this sense he has of timing and of sound and of things, some things being very slow and some things being very abrupt. Like, there are things which open absurdly fast.
Yeah, it's shocking. There's also been a long build-up. Nothing's happened.
At the end, they have the garage which they've had installed, which opens and is this big thing which opens and closes terrifyingly fast. It goes like whoom, whoom.
Yeah, it's like pneumatically actuated garage door with two little eyes in it, yeah. Which they can. There's lots of peering out of windows.
Yeah. It's very funny.
I didn't realise the circular window was such a big thing, but it's something he's taking the piss of constantly in that film.
It's kind of one of the ornaments of classical modernism, isn't it?
Porthole. Yeah, straight out of Liners.
Both these films have a long party scene towards the end, which is where things start to break down, and I think there's something important about the way the parties go, and he gives them a lot of time, and he allows all of the various characters to develop and
this one is quite long, but the one in playtime is extremely long.
It's like an hour long in playtime.
The one in playtime is as long as a film, almost. Yeah.
It's basically half the film is the one in playtime. In this one, they're all having a little garden party. There's a certain amount of clowning on the part of Hulo, who ends up like walking into the pond by mistake and
then he has
to
disguise the fact that he has wet feet.
But it's interesting. I think that it's important that the happiest person at the party is the husband's second. He's the assistant or his like number two from the factory. The Hulo manages to break the fountain by accidentally like stabbing it with a sort of.
They've got these very convenient. Try this. It's very convenient, and it's a metal spike with two like. Glass holders in it, and you can put your glass in, so you sort of stab it into the ground, but the ground is all curvy paths and a curvy pond and then patches of like brown and green and then stepping stones.
The paths, I think, really dramatize this whole sort of web of pretension and kind of absurdity which is structuring everyone's interaction, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't go anywhere straight.
You have to walk along these there's this very funny like serpentine path, and when two people are walking from either end to come and greet each other, at first they look as if they're walking away from each other and then they come together. Yeah, so anyway, the fountain breaks and the second in command, I can't remember his name anyway, like takes off various bits of his suit and digs an enormous hole in order to fix it, he is the one who has the best time at the party.
And his wife Hulo presumably is telling naughty jokes to people, and different people react differently, and she finds it very funny. She also is the only person who sees what several things happening, but she has no lines. She just laughs.
It's really important that the person who has a great time at the party is the one who kind of punctures all of the pretension. He like rolls up his sleeves and just gets on with this thing, and they have fun in the fixing of them.
And then there's the fashion woman who is wearing these crazy outfits and is incredibly equine.
The wife is trying to set her up with her with Monsieur Hulo, who is her brother. You know,
yeah. I would say her characteristics are mad fashion dress, neurosis, and enormous teeth.
Yes, but it is important. There's something about the dynamic of the party, which is where everything starts to fray, and where sort of humanity can emerge through this kind of entropy, where all of the other structures of modernity
dissolve.
It's the carnival,
isn't it? Yeah. Everything is inverted. Yeah. Everything is inverted at carnival. Everything transgresses and falls apart. Some steam is let out, but then everything goes back to normal.
Yeah.
It is not primarily transformative. Now, there is actually a transformation, but the transformation is very subtle and slight. It's not... The people don't learn that their life is silly. Modernism isn't beaten back. Modernism was going to win at the beginning, and it's going to win at the end.
Yeah.
Capitalism, the American business model, men in funny suits, having to work.
I mean, nostalgia is innately about... an irrecoverable past, isn't it? That's what kind of produces that quality of longing. So should we just talk about the end of this one? Because that's sort
yes,
of captures
so
the...
There's the bacchanalia, and then that finishes in the next scene, if I remember rightly. Is Monsieur Hugo breaking into the garden to prune... Like, earlier on, the boy has broken a branch off a sort of espaliered tree, and he prunes another one off to balance it, but one of the branches is too thick for his set of secateurs, and he really feels that he could have done a better job at evening it up.
So he comes back in the middle of the night like a cat burglar.
Yeah, like a cat burglar, and there's a funny scene of the heads being eyeballs rolling around
yeah,
in these
round
windows.
Yeah, the two heads of the couple appear in the porthole windows, so it looks like not like two eyes.
But ultimately what happens is Monsieur Hulot gets up to more japes, gets a bit drunk, not really through any fault of his own, and then falls asleep on their sofa.
That's the final straw,
and the dad is going to give him a job as a travelling salesman.
So he'll have to go away.
And they all take him in the car. There's a, you know, the sad departure from his little house. Yeah. He says bye to the characters, or sort of nearly, and is taken to the airport.
Oh yeah, there's that funny trans. The girl, you can sort of tell that
she's blossomed.
Yeah, there's a sort of sweet schoolgirl at the beginning, and then yes, with the turning of the leaves, she's turned into a babe.
Yeah, but she's still the same person.
She is the same person, but her outfit has changed from schoolgirl to kind of vaguely gypsy-ish, with a washing basket under her arm.
Yes, that's something that happens in French films, isn't it? But that's not what's happening here.
No, he's not very sexual, Monsieur Hulot. Although
he's not
there
at
are,
all.
But there are... There are
he's a gentleman.
Of, he has moments of sort of
he's
romance,
attracted,
doesn't
he? He's attracted to the bimbo.
He is attracted to nice girls as well, in a funny way, but nothing ever comes of it. But anyway, so he's got to be sent away, and we kind of reprise this scene that we had at the very start of the film, where we drive out past the wave of demolition kind of moving ever closer.
Yeah, there's people, but now they're literally demolishing... Like, you go around the corner from his house and they're knocking down the one, like, three doors down. And he sort of disappears into the airport, and it's so sad. But it's redeemed. Because although he is having to become a modern man and conform to the contemporary economy, the father is now prepared to make someone walk into a lamppost to bond with his son.
They do the trick of getting someone to walk into a lamppost.
And then that's it. That's where it was left for a decade. Because the next film was mired in production hell.
So one of the things which I didn't realise until I watched them back to back is that Playtime is literally a sequel, and that Hulot is in this very modern kind of vision of Paris, sort of modernist, international modernist Paris, all identical, cuboidal, sort of pinstriped curtain wall.
They're exactly Mies van der Rohe monoliths. They're slightly lighter grey.
But he's there for a business meeting. He's come to town.
He's a travelling salesman. He's going to presumably sell miles and miles of red plastic tubing.
So one of the differences in Playtime is that the balance between these two poles, which existed in Mon Oncle, the balance between the old and the new, has shifted, and we're almost entirely enveloped in the new city, this amazing set which he built at enormous expense for the production, nicknamed Tattyville.
We think the budget is approximately 40 to 45 times more.
It was really big. They're quite amazing pictures. I'm going to put some up on the Instagram, but they look amazing. And they're all, and there's all this wonderful false perspective. So you
modernist
have them.
Blocks on rails. They're false perspective, so they're smaller than real life. Like, maybe half the size.
They're still quite big things, yeah. It's presented in this very ironized way. The old Paris is present, but it's deliberately shown only really as reflections. So there's this thing which happens a couple of times where someone opens a door, a glass door, and in the reflection of the door you see the Eiffel Tower or...
the Arc de Triomphe. Those are, that's it. That's the sum total of old Paris.
I think the Sacré-Cœur appears in one somewhere. There's a moment, yeah.
Missed it.
Yeah. Well, it's very
easy
much...
easy to miss things. This is a film which is even more... The other one was a set piece with an ensemble cast. This one, the lens is a little bit wider, the shot is a little bit slower, and there are more things going on simultaneously.
There's a real Where's Wally with Monsieur Hulot, where so it begins, as you say, at Orly Airport, but which I think is a kind of fantasy Orly Airport, isn't it?
I'm not even sure if... Is it called... It's just called Airport.
There's a pretty consistent material palette across the whole of the modern city, which is this brushed steel. So everything is lined in this slightly reflective, dully reflective grey.
And all walls are glass curtain walls. All exterior walls. Interior walls are not, but exterior ones.
Yeah, and so we're in this, we're in the airport in various different bits.
A typical shot even quite early on in the airport. It's sort of high up on a floor above, and you're just watching. There's a couple of nuns. There's like a German military officer who's waiting for his subordinate to... And then he's like waiting, storming up, and then his subordinate brings him a piece of paper and a present, and he's angry with him for being late. But this is just happening down there, and at the same time...
Yeah, there's a kind of husband and wife, and the wife is sort of fussing over the husband.
In the beginning, it's not clear if that... Because I wasn't sure if he was going into, like, a medical appointment or something. There's nothing to tell you what's going on. There's this cleaner, this, like, dumpy man who's waiting for a piece of dirt somewhere. He's got, like, a brush, dustpan and brush. And he's just waiting, but there never is any.
And gradually these tour parties start to arrive as well, who are some of the people we're going to follow through the whole movie. Is this all-female tour party from America who've come to visit Paris. And
who's divided into two. There's a group of Japanese businessmen.
Yeah, who reappear at various times. And there's Monsieur Hulot, there's a kind of Where's Wally of Monsieur Hulot, where you see someone who might be him a few times.
Because he's wearing like the absolutely classic... I've got that Mac in that cupboard.
People keep going up and tapping on him on the shoulder and saying, oh, Monsieur Hulot, but it's not him.
People think he is someone else.
Actually, the first time you think it's him, it's not him. It's some English guy.
Some English guy played by a French person hamming up English in a sort of reverse hello, really straight.
So it takes a long time, but we do... I can't even remember, how do we eventually get to him?
And people go through, like, passport control and stuff, but this is olden days flying, so basically an airport is just an empty box before they kept thinking of more and more awful things to put in it.
Yeah. Well, these were the days when it was very easy to walk onto a plane with a gun and make them fly you to Damascus or whatever.
I object to the security thing enormously less than I object to the serpentine mock travertine. I mean, even if you do play how many whiskey samples can you get while going through the airport, it's still pretty unsatisfying.
Oh, I saw someone posted the actual plan of the Stansted shopping area now, which is so egregious.
It's satanic. I think we should demolish Stansted.
Yes, pour encourager les autres, as they say.
Exactly, yes. The English like to hang an admiral, it encourages the rest.
We really follow that tour party, don't we? They get on their buses.
They're counted many... Oh, God, I've done that a few times, the counting bit.
They're kind of driving for ages, and they're doing lots of sightseeing out
the
windows of the bus.
By the way. Yeah. I wish buses were like that.
Yeah, so you sort of drive and you start to encounter this new city, which are all of these identical
They're all, it's identical Mesian blocks.
And they're it's very ironic the way they're presented, you know, the sort of sun behind them. He doesn't quite play whatever that bloody piece of classical music, you know, the like monolith music that they play in 2001. But it is that kind of absurd. He's doing a little bit of that kind of...
Yeah, it looks like Brasilia. It's like that, you know, that like run of there's a pond and there's two rows of monolith, Mesian monoliths.
And one of the jokes which you encounter here and which goes on a lot more is everyone's taking pictures of the identical international modernist buildings.
And they're so similar that Monsieur Hulot does not realise that he is no longer in the one he was in, but in the one next to it.
When he eventually appears, he's got to go and have this appointment with this man. And really, that's all the plot there is he has to meet this guy. He's very busy. He follows him. They're about to talk, and he accidentally gets separated from him.
There are these two buildings with glass curtains. He is outside.
Yeah.
And he sees the reflection of the man's reflection in the other building's glass.
Yeah.
The man can't get out to him, and he thinks the other person's in the other building, and so he goes into that building, and in that building there is a bizarre trade show going on, which is selling all the things which are in the other one.
Yeah, all these chairs and things. We have more of these absurd chairs. There's like a long scene of these very funny-looking chairs, which is kind of too low and made of... They must have been inflated or something.
I think what it is it's like pleather-covered, really basic foam... So that as the foam goes down, the air builds up in the thing, and then it squeaks, and then it pops back into shape.
This is all about his timing again. That it regains its original shape, but after an irregular amount of time, and sometimes it takes quite a long time, and then pops back into shape again suddenly, but for no particular reason.
There's a bit of earlier on of him waiting, and the shot is like there's a security guard who has got this massive control panel on a structural column, which has got like 50 buttons and lights, and he doesn't really know how, the old guy doesn't really know how to use it. And then sitting behind the column is a chair, and he eventually manages to get the thing to work, having said he doesn't really understand it. And then the scene is a guy walking down this corridor, and it's echoing loads, so the joke is you think he must be around the corner, but it takes him 20 seconds or something, which is literally 20 seconds, maybe longer than that, just walking up.
Because essentially it's just an intercom, isn't it? Yeah. It's just so he can call the guy.
But in order to do that, he has to, like, press a button, then press another button, which, like, interlinks two things, and then flick a switch twice, and then press another button, which causes something to flash. It reminds me of the control panel at the leisure centre of my youth, which had quite a complicated control panel, which included things like water, heat, bicoloured lights, security lights, doors.
He encounters this this kind of brusque, smartly dressed American guy who I think is called Mr. Wax, who comes in and sits down. But he when he sits down in the chair, he does this strange sort of rhythmic dance of taking things out of his briefcase, flicking the paper, and it's all this like dun 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 dun,
making noises.
Yeah, but it's totally rhythmic. And I thought it was one of the things which, because when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, you know, how much do we want to contextualize what's going on? And obviously, there is this analysis of of modernity and of life under kind of capitalism, of being characterized by certain like rhythms. People like Gaston Bachelard and Henri Lefebvre have this idea of rhythm analysis as being one of the sort of modes of analyzing the condition of everyday life under capitalism.
It's like he sits down, strikes the dust off the end of his trouser, opens his zipper, gets out a pen, dots a thing,
Flicks the paper.
Snips, like flicks the paper. Squirts something up his nose. Yeah, and he looks like one of those really good guys in the city who really look like they could have, like, so many dead people in their flat. He tries to find the man. They don't find each other. Eventually, the man runs, runs into a glass wall and, like, breaks his nose and then calls off the quest.
One of the most famous scenes in the sort of seeking after him is he's on a floor, on a kind of mezzanine above, looking down at all of these little cubicles, and he can see the man kind of moving around in, yes, in between them and going
so
in and out.
So the man is rung up
ones
by someone in another cubicle at the other end and asks for the like totals for the accounts, and then he says yes, gets out, goes to the cubicle that he's in, and in the outside of it is a filing cabinet, withdraws the index card, goes back to his cubicle, and then rings. You know, there's all of that sort of thing going on.
Yeah, it's this whole kind
of... cubicles are also amazing, and before their time, everything is like a really over-specced but quite plausible.
Yeah, I mean, that bit was kind of prescient, wasn't it? But that, also, it's that everything is steel. So everything has this kind of... or aluminium or something. It's all kind of steely grey. It feels much more... the office is much more like a factory. If you think of the kind of... the real crap office of the 80s, 90s, those partition cubicles are all covered in... like the very sort of distinctive sort of horrible fabric on chipboard, aren't they?
Either mylar laminated chipboard or fabric which is sort of upholstered with a staple gun onto MDF.
Whereas this one is all, yeah, it feels very much more like a factory. It feels very sort of chic, sleek and machine-like.
Like a McLaren car factory, not like a...
Because everything is so sort of reflective and there's all this glass, there's always... things are just sort of on the edge of these amazing atmospheric effects, aren't they? They're all always sort of happening around, so there is always this slight edge of the miraculous. It's not kind of the dead, flat, fluorescent environment that it would actually turn out to be.
It's all lit by these enormous, triple-height glass curtain walls. It's visually very impressive.
Yeah, an amazing set. There's a lot more of this sort of absurd furniture that we've already identified in the trade show that he ends up in.
God, it did have some real ringers for the Ideal Home Show. Yeah. That broom. There's a moment when there's a broom brought out, and the broom is very flexible and has two headlights which you power by dropping batteries into the arm of it, which seems completely grotesque until you've been to Interiors trade show, where there are people who are doing things that are far more stupid than that. And I definitely remember a guy, and he was selling the all silicone broom, and his shtick was he had three concrete pedestals. One was covered with polished concrete, one was covered with laminate flooring, and one was covered with vinyl flooring. And then he had plastic balls, and he'd pour some plastic balls onto the polished surface and then demonstrate that his all silicone broom could sweep them off it. And he was doing that all day with terrific enthusiasm.
Yeah,
that's something that hasn't changed at all, this sort of strange gizmo pitch.
I think the sales pitch is that it's really good for cleaning under tables, isn't it?
Because it's got its headlights.
And there's
this
wonderful moment where it goes under the table and this bright light shines out from underneath it.
Oh, so that's what it's for. But they were really up for it before they knew what it was for.
Yeah. There's this wonderfully absurd inversion of his normal trick with sound, where there's a guy who's invented this sort of soft close door.
Which says, slam your doors in silence.
Because of some kind of complicated piece of mistaken identity, he gets incredibly angry at Monsieur Hulot, and it ends up with him slamming his own door several times to try and make a point, but of course it doesn't make any noise at all, so which is very funny.
And he's a German who always... This man is a character, he can't speak in anything other than German for more than 5 seconds, and when he's talking in German, he oscillates between angry Hitler and benevolent chum.
Yeah.
Like...
But he reappears at the end, or towards the end, because he's actually the guy who brings Hulot into the restaurant. Yeah. So, I mean, we've got up to about halfway through it here, and then there's an hour-long scene in a new restaurant called the Royal Garden.
A few things have happened before then. He keeps meeting, accidentally bumping into people he was in the army with, three different ones. Eventually speaks to one who he doesn't really like, but... keeps inviting him into his flat.
He brings them in for whiskey. Yeah, it's a very modern flat, and they have this.
Our first recording venue, opposite it, was exactly this.
Yeah, they're like the flat has almost these. It's on the ground floor, and they have these sort of shop windows, so you just see from the street directly into their living room. And there's this strange.
And that was what we looked out on in our first.
Yeah.
It's exactly that.
This is another one of these. These kind of, it is a sight gag, but it's not like a laugh out loud one. It's just this sort of slightly sort of wistful, maybe slightly melancholy one where that you see the two flats together. One is him and his friend, and one, by coincidence, is the guy he'd been trying to meet all day in the office. But they're both watching television on an unseen wall, which is between the two windows. And so they look as if they're in dialogue, don't they? They sort of look as if they're looking at one another, but they're not really looking at one another at all.
Rather like they were in the same office and the guy had the file next to his desk. You know, they're all doing the equivalent of writing emails to each other. And now people who are right next to each other, instead of being like Monorque, with all the people he'd always say hello to on the staircase, everyone is alienated in identical environments. It's also amazing how long a scene that is without any sound, because you hear nothing, you just see what's going on in the flat. Cars drive by, basically.
Yeah, quite amazing. And then we enter this restaurant scene. This is where we meet the, like, hapless architect.
Missoula is walking down the street and he sees a construction site and he hears jazz music and people are like moving this enormous pane of glass, and it turns out this is the construction site of this restaurant which is going to open in a few hours but still hasn't.
Yeah, they're literally putting it together. They're putting the floor tiles down, but all the tables are already laid and ready for the guests. and there's a huge ensemble of people who we see. There's just lots of things going on. There are the waiters who, someone keeps drinking the wine. They think one of the waiters, it seems like he might be getting drunk, and there's the kind of the owner is trying to work out who's been at the wine. But there's lots of things going on. Yeah, one of them is that the architect is wandering around.
And there are so many stupid things. There's the problem with Pilates we addressed in the last episode.
Yeah, there's a column in the which people keep walking into.
Which is in the middle of the lobby.
There are the chairs. There's another wonderful chair.
Do they have, like, wet paint on them, or are they just very spiky?
But how does
it mark a woman's back?
It doesn't really make sense, but they have these sort of metal chairs with a crown, and the crown gets stamped into the back of everyone's jacket and also into the bare backs of the women in their dresses.
It's dancing sort of like a brand. On the dance floor, and there's two couples, and... woman in both cases nudges the man and is like, look at that fool with an impression on the back of his jacket. And then the other one does it the other way around, and neither of them can see they've got it on their own back. Except that that's just something that's happening in a crowd scene where the eye is drawn to the right thing, but there's just tons of stuff going on.
Gradually everyone is drawn into the restaurant. And, you know, the tour party of Americans who we've been following end up there. Lots of people who we've seen at other points in the film end up there. Hulot ends up there.
There's, like, five different waiters. There's two chefs. There's a manager, a sub-manager, two barmen, a doorman, another doorman. All of these are characters who do something.
Yeah, who have, like, a recurring joke.
They all have a recurring joke or tick. There's a lot of stuff going on. That every single waiter's clothes break, but the guy whose clothes first broke has to swap bits of his good clothing, and he's just standing outside being unhappy, and he ends up with ripped jacket, ripped trousers in an unfortunate place, a broken shoe, a clip-on bow tie that's been covered in this turbot sauce, which is like perpetually being set on fire.
Yeah, the only thing they seem to serve is this huge, horrible fish covered in lemon slices and
and sort of gruel,
and
something.
Which they have to, yeah, they have to season it in front of the guests. That's
but
what you
the
do.
The same one is just moved around and repeatedly seasoned without ever.
No one eats it.
What happens is this, the waiter, having seasoned it, gets called away before giving it to the people. And then it's moved to another table and then seasoned again. And then eventually it's set on fire.
Yeah. Because they put too much liquor on it.
Yeah, and way too many people come to this opening.
And gradually, so there are lots of problems with the design already, which you can see the thing which they've got to slide the fish through is too small, and there's a builder ready to smash down a bit of wall.
He's got a really good... Slightly jealous of his plasterboard knife. It's amazing. It's like a saber.
As the party, and this is a sort of a point of recurrence from the previous film, is that the party starts to generate its own energy. We kind of move into this new space where different things are possible, and as that happens, the restaurant just literally falls apart around them.
It disintegrates, but becomes really cool. Everyone starts to get quite drunk. There's this American. His characteristic is he's constantly wanting people to do fun and throwing money at people in an obscene way.
Yes. I wonder. I mean, I think that this is a period when maybe Americans had a sort of particular signification. I think that they signified being free of all of the kind of rather hidebound, sort of haughty pretensions of the old world.
I think if you think of the different life situation also of Americans visiting Paris, who would be very well-off Americans, because...
I think there's meant to be a cultural thing, though, as well. I mean, I think that they're meant to signify, like, spontaneity. And the band gradually gets, like... throughout all the films, there's really fun, good music.
Fun, good, but also very repetitive. In Mon Oncle, there's one song...
I mean, it's probably played already by the time you've got to this, unless we go out to it. But yeah, the band in the restaurant, like the music kind of builds and builds, and it gets more and more. They have a bit where it gets very sort of rhythmic, very driven by the rhythm section, and there's lots of like, you know, the dancing gets wilder and wilder. And at a certain point, the American is trying to jump up and touch the ceiling.
Someone's flower gets caught in a wooden, like, clapboard, a woman, and Monsieur Hugo jumps up to get it for her.
Yeah, and pulls down.
And brings the ceiling down.
Yeah. And all these, it's these kind of wooden slats, and they all come down to form...
Yeah, they come down to form this work of modern art that the American wants to buy.
But they sort of form a kind of, yeah, a strange little enclosure. And the leaders of the party, this American guy and also Monsieur Hulot, and like...
There's an attractive woman who kind of fills the sort of... She's got all the attractive characteristics. She likes old Paris.
Nice, thoughtful. You can tell she has her kind of save the cat moment, which happens in the airport, is that there's the sound of a dog inside a bag, and she's distracted by it and goes over to pet it, and like that's, you can tell that she's the nice person.
Dogs are strong virtue signals.
Yeah. Yeah, very strong. It forms this sort of funny little enclosure, and they go inside and have an even more raucous party inside there, and the American has made this funny little door which he's either letting people in or out of in the fallen slats,
and it just becomes chaos.
Yeah.
And eventually
the band leave because even more of the ceiling falls in.
Plays romantic French songs on the piano, and an old lady comes up and sings songs with her, and then eventually they all go out as the light is dawning, and they go to this weird combined pharmacy like cafe, or I think the pharmacy is over the road, and they carry on the party a bit there, and then they've all got to go home.
Hulot has like this little romantic moment with the girl, doesn't he? Because they, and he takes her, as any good French man should, cheese shopping.
Well, he knocks a sponge or is it a soap off this thing,
like, kicks
this along the street.
It's butter, isn't it? Because they're all cheese. They're like these cheese stalls.
No, but they're like the stall that he knocks it off.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
It's like sponges. It's called like a sponge or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then he knocks it and he puts the sponge, and there's a joke of like sponge versus Swiss cheese. And it's next to this enormous Swiss cheese, and he puts this sponge up next to it because he thinks it goes there.
So that's the...
I think.
They do a kind of...
A lot of the jokes rely on the fact that this was filmed in 70mm and meant to be shown on an enormous screen. And in fact, part of the reason it was a financial catastrophe is he refused to have it shown at cinemas that didn't have 70mm projectors, i.e. nearly all of them. You've got some of the jokes to work. You have to see incredibly small things.
Yeah, so they do that, and then he buys her a little present.
Scarf, printed scarf, with the Eiffel Tower on it, which is what she wanted.
But he's trapped in the... by the like exit system of the shop.
And so he gives it to a young man to give to her. It's very sweet.
Yeah.
But she gets it.
And that's kind of the end, isn't it?
And then she goes off and that's the end of the holiday, and it's called Playtime, and it's about it feels like it's about Proust's Sunday morning, you know. Mm. It's about the time when mostly there's a little sort of 20 minutes at the beginning which is work. And in fact, he does eventually meet the guy, and they do have a chat.
They do their business, don't they?
Sort of off camera, but it's implied that actually, ultimately, the trip was a success. But mainly it's about holiday. But holiday in a working city. And there are various criticisms of modernity, some of which work and some of which are a bit like the Flanders and Swan songs criticising the 1950s, you know?
Yeah.
The one of everything this being the same is a bit funny because... well, we've kind of lived through it now, and some things are the same everywhere and some things are different. And also, the object with strange affordances is kind of gone because it's just everything just is a computer screen.
Yeah, there's still like a lot of human warmth and things, isn't there? It's just that they're in this absurd setting. The absurdity of modern life is constantly foregrounded and exaggerated, isn't it?
But the people aren't... I mean, there are a few sort of Ubermensch wandering around the offices, but most people actually are just people, and they're just as confused as Monsieur Hulot. What the hell's going on?
No, actually, the old man the joke with the old man is he clearly doesn't understand how it works at all, but he keeps saying how he understands what he's doing. He's like, oh, it's very easy once you understand how to use it, or something.
There's two things that have gone. One is the silent film legacy, like visual humour. And one is Horace satire, you know, very gentle satire that doesn't try and upturn order. His satire doesn't say the world is deeply wrong. It says the excesses of the world need to be moderated. Nothing is ever bad. There's no real bad consequences. Things work out. The really classic Hulot joke for me is a man is painting something by the sea. His can of paint is swept back. But every time he's dipping his paintbrush in it, it's swept back.
Yeah, it keeps coming in and out on the waves.
Coming in and out on the wave, and he hasn't noticed it's gone away, but that's because it's working perfectly fine.
Yeah. That's in Monsieur Hulot's Holiday,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that is in Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. God, I haven't seen that film since I was a child.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. I remember it now.
That's a perfect tatty joke. You think something bad's going to happen, but it... I mean, and the consequence is extremely mild. The consequence is a man finding out that his paint bucket is 2 feet behind him. But it doesn't. It's just good. It's funny, I can remember it in colour, but I'd swear that film is in black and white.
It is in black and white, yeah.
That is several years affecting my memory, isn't it? You must have seen these films as a kid.
Yeah.
I'd never seen Mon Oncle.
It's good, isn't it?
I'd seen the others.
Mon Oncle, I think, is the one... Things are very sort of clear in Mon Oncle. I mean, Mon Oncle is a more enjoyable film. Playtime does go on a bit. I very much admire auteurish bravura of doing this 1 hour ensemble restaurant scene where nothing really happens except lots of various little absurd things. And actually Playtime in general as this amazing set of...
I mean, it's not as if a huge amount happens in Mon Oncle, but it's that really...
Yeah, but you know...
But there is an arc.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, actually, you could sort of break down Mon Oncle into a pretty sort of standard structure. You can see the arcs that all of the characters go on, the way in which it's resolved, the sort of the moments of crisis which happen at various points.
It's kind of a five-act play.
But Playtime is really quite radical, I think. I mean, we were talking... I can't remember if we recorded this or not, but we were sort of talking about the cinema of the mass, or like...
I don't think we did. I think although the work is critical of modernism, it is high modernist. Visual culture of it is from silent film, and in fact so is the sound culture. It's about the relationship man alienated against the mass. Alienation is a real key, is the key quality of modernity.
But it also tries to depict the mass, doesn't it? Like, its subject is the city, the people of the city. There were moments which I felt was very directly referential. I might be making this up, but, you know, there's a moment when the street cleaners come along early in the morning, which is right at the end, which is, for me, was very reminiscent. The documentary film, Berlin Symphony of Metropolis, which is this 20s film, which is just like a day in the life of the city, and it kind of goes all the way through. It has the latter part is a big party. You know, you go from all of these trains at the beginning, all the shops opening up, and you kind of go through the rhythm of a whole day, all the factories,
it's
all
true.
Of everything.
That's a great modernist thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's Ulysses.
Yeah, and it is really, a day in the life of the city. It's drawing on all of these things from high modernism, but which are then being pitted against kind of modernism after the avant-garde. It's modernism as an actually achieved thing. It's modernism when the age of heroes is past. This is a predicament we think about quite a lot in terms of post-war architecture, because it's so much more of a thing that modernism sort of happened in the 20s, and then after the war, suddenly it was everywhere. And the culture of architecture and kind of the sort of discourse of architecture after the war is that everyone has to deal with how they reposition themselves against the disappointment of the avant-garde having actually triumphed in this strange way. Weird ambivalence.
An art movement is always a process. Yeah. And actually, I don't think it had finished. And I think part of the sign that modernism hadn't finished is that this is a modernist film.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't ultimately say that the project is wrong, which something made 10 years later would, probably.
Yeah, no, it's not Koyaanisqatsi, lots of footage of all of these buildings being blown up.
Cast against the sausage factory.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that at all, which makes it quite interesting. I think we'll deal with late modernism at some point. I think we'll do some not modernism as well.
Yeah, well, it's something I'm really trying to get my head around. I think that it's very difficult to figure out.
You know my theory of the big problem, which is that first-generation modernist volume house building is far too boring to be excited about as a sort of avant-garde theorist who thinks you're really important. Yeah. And so they built a load of it, and then they found it was too boring, and then they had to think of ways to justify doing something more interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that's not wrong. I mean, I think that that is part of the dynamic is, well, they sort of did it, and then it was disappointing in lots of ways. They were let down. But they don't necessarily want to abandon the whole enterprise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, should we say something about the sort of postscript to Tati's life? So there's a couple of
The first thing is this film, like, he spent tons of money on it and basically bankrupted himself.
It really kind of crippled the remainder of his career after this. I guess he was about 60 when this happened.
I also think you'd seen a natural arc where his films were developing in a direction, and I don't think there was much good beyond this in that direction.
Yeah. So there is a script for an unmade film, which was going to be an Ulo film called Confusion, which was a strange... I haven't been able to get hold of the script, but apparently it's a sort of strange sci-fi thing where Ulo is accidentally killed quite early on in the script. It's got like a musical collaboration with Sparks, and I don't really know what would have happened, but it's moving past modernity into kind of speculative science fiction. He did do a couple more films. He did one called Traffic, which is a sort of Dutch TV movie where he rather improbably plays a car designer who designs this absurd camper van which keeps breaking down in different ways. And yeah, and
there was even another one after that, but they're not very well regarded.
No.
I think they are a mess, aren't they? That's what people say about them.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing Traffic. I mean, one of the things actually we didn't really get round to is that among the many absurdities of modernity, the absolute sort of centrality of the spectacle of cars driving around in silly little lanes.
In Mononcle, they go in threes, so they're all at like three abreast down the road in an orderly grid. And a key scene in playtime is at the end, when everything is going well and they're about to leave, and sort of the end, there's this roundabout and it becomes a carousel. A girl riding on the back of her boyfriend's moped sort of starts going up and down, and then there are cars being jacked up and down in a Pirelli tire fitting facility, and various other sort of that contribute to the kind of delirious air of carnival.
So yeah, no, I'm going to try and check those out. But those two definitely worth watching, aren't they?
Yeah, they're great. Actually, would recommend. Those four films, the first four films.
Yeah.
They're all great.
A lot of fun. A lot of fun. So I think we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks for those people who got in touch.
Yeah, we've had some nice, very nice emails. Thank you very much.
We had one from Russia. We had one from somewhere where people plaster.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Happy painting and plastering. Yeah, it's great. It's fun to learn what people are doing. It doesn't have to be listening in the bath or anything kind of salacious like that. It can just be productive.
I imagine some people listen on their way to work. Some people listen at work. We definitely get a lot more listens in the week than at the weekend.
Yeah, gosh, almost as if people have better things to do.
The hours of repose seem to have be more... do get in touch.
Yeah.
aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com. Or there's a Twitter.
There's a Twitter. We're at About Buildings on Twitter and Insta.
On Instagram, we put relevant images, which can help you evoke what we're talking about.
Yeah, I will put some stuff up for this. I've got a bunch of screenshots and also images of Tattyville looking extremely bizarre. So that's all to look forward to. Anyway, we're rambling on anyway. So we should bid you au revoir, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Yes. Goodbye.
Yeah, a bientôt.
Goodbye.
Bye. Beep, 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 beep.